The following is Luke Rablewski's keynote, Mobile Behavior and Design Trends from the 2014 UX Immersion Conference.
So I'll tell you how I started out my morning. So I arrive at the hotel, I have a bag with my luggage inside, and I wake up in the morning, and I'm going to, you know, go to the shower, and I want to brush my teeth. And I'm looking all over, and I can't find my little toothbrush case. And I just destroy the suitcase, tear it apart, look for it everywhere. It's missing. So in an act of desperation, I take one of these little washcloths and I put my toothpaste on it and I brush my teeth with a little towel and it seems adequate. I get out of the shower, I sort of walk into the hotel room and there is sitting my hygiene kit. So that's the kind of day I'm having. I hope you guys are having a good day. But if I sound a little discoherent here and there, blame it on the toothpaste. Okay, but I'm not here to talk to you guys about toothpaste. I'm here to talk about mobile design. And in order to talk about mobile design, Jared actually did a real nice favor for me by bringing up the fact that I used to work over at NCSA. Does anybody know what NCSA is? So it's the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. Sounds big and mighty, right? But it's actually where Mosaic came out, which is the first graphical web browser that gained any measure of popularity. That became Netscape Navigator when Mark Andreessen went over to Silicon Valley with it. It became Internet Explorer through the Spyglass deal. And it sort of kicked off the web. So I started off back in the mid-90s working at NCSA, and it was a really amazing time to get involved with the Internet and with computers. Because if you sort of see what was happening back then in terms of global sales of PCs, that is how many of these personal computers were making their way into the planet. Keep in mind, this is a relatively new phenomenon, but it's a really good run, right? Just up and to the right. And if you're involved in technology, every single day, more and more people around the world now have access to the internet, have access to the web. And in the mid-90s, you know, we built things that looked like traditional websites. This is one of the things I did over at NCSA. You can see, you know, like menus, text, images, all the sorts of things we do right now. But it was actually a lot of sea-changing things that led us to actually do that. Because NCSA was a research institution, and the whole point of the web back then was to, like, share research documents. We've come a pretty long way. So that was a cool period. And then what happened was the bubble burst. Does anybody remember that? Right, the dot-com crash, can't even remember what else you want to call it, Armageddon, if you lived in Silicon Valley. And so what happened was global sales of personal computers actually went down a bit. If you look from then, that had never happened before. And then they kind of flatlined and plateaued for a number of years. So this great growth and this explosion we had really kind of took a hit for a bit. And it was right around that time that I stayed at the university, taught some classes. But then towards the end of it, I decided to actually go and take a job over in Silicon Valley working for eBay. I did 2.5 years at eBay, 4.5 years at Yahoo. And again, that period of my life turned out to be a really great run. Because if you just look at global sales of PCs, right, that was an even better run. Look at how many people now have access to the web, how many people are on the internet, and how many people we can reach with our apps and our services and our content and our interactions. And then, though a lot of time passed there, right, it was like a 10, 12-year period, the things that we were making for the web still kind of looked the same, right? My mid-90s NCSA design skills were totally applicable when we redid the Yahoo homepage or when we redid selling on eBay. The scale was a lot bigger, so we learned a lot more. And the bar was a lot higher in terms of design, but the core principles and the interactions and all those things, you know, they sort of held tight. And what basically happened is we could apply that to more and more people, more and more use cases, more and more things. So again, a very exciting time period. But towards the end of 2009 and into 2010, something else happened to this line, which is it flatlined, and then last year in 2013, it dropped precipitously. This is the biggest drop in worldwide personal computer sales we've ever had as an industry. Right? Again, follow that chart. There's only been that one during the crash, and it was much less marked than this one. So that started in 2010, sales sort of plateaued. And in 2013, they really fell off a cliff. And in order to illustrate what's behind this, what I'm going to do is just sort of zoom out on this graph and build up the vertical axis for a second here. All right, so scale's a little bit off, but I think it's illustrative to show what's going on. If we didn't have the scale like this, the PC rise wouldn't look nearly as awesome as it actually was, right? But let me add another line to this chart, which is the global sales of smartphones and tablets. Anybody see something interesting in this chart that you might want to pay attention to? One of the more interesting things about this chart is that this moment where these two lines crossed actually happened a lot earlier than people predicted. There was these wild predictions that global sales of PCs would be surpassed by smartphones and tablets in 2012. But it actually ended up happening almost 2 years earlier, towards the late end of 2010. And this is sales worldwide of these kinds of devices. Right? And I call that moment where these two things cross, where the mobile line crosses your conventional personal computing line, the mobile moment. I think it's an interesting concept to think about. It's a very simple idea, right? You have this non-mobile internet, software, computer stuff, and then you have the mobile version of that. And when those two lines cross, you hit this mobile moment. I've been tracking when companies publicly say they cross this. So this is not nearly an exhaustive list, but it shows how many people are actually crossing this line and when. So Facebook, the Weather Channel, the music radio service, Pandora, this happened to them about 3 years ago. Twitter and Google Plus, which everybody uses, happened in 2012. So what that means is all three of the Google Plus users in existence got an iPhone. 2013, Amazon, ESPN, Yelp. 2014, YouTube, LinkedIn, CNN, all these other companies are either there or about to cross the line. So that's in terms of traffic, of usage, right? Your audience size for these companies is larger on mobile than it is on conventional PCs. So that's an interesting thing to keep in mind. But it's not only just your user base, it's also revenue, right? So if you look at mobile holiday shopping in the US, you see a similar trend where for a couple years it was sort of on the up and up, and then last year it crossed that mobile moment. So not only have a lot of internet services had their mobile moment, commerce in general in the United States, and the busiest time of commerce of the entire year had its mobile moment. And I bring these things up because if you're selling stuff or if you're using social media like Facebook or Twitter to talk about the things you're selling or about your businesses, these things are over the 50% mark. If you're sending emails, same story. Global opens of email, mobile versus desktop, right? It was 20% mobile in 2011, went up a bit, and again in 2013, we crossed this mobile moment. So it's not just the audiences, it's actually the kinds of things that they're doing is shifting as well, which leads to big opportunities. So here's PayPal. 2010, they did a decent amount of mobile payment volume. Certainly went up the following year. The year after that, they seem to have gotten a little bit more growth. And last year, they did $27 billion in mobile payments. And that's the impact of all these mobile moments, right? The traffic mobile moment, the usage mobile moments, all these things translate to direct money. And now, this year, we've actually had a bunch of companies coming out and saying they're actually making more money off of mobile than off of conventional personal computers. And this is an interesting thing because the prevailing thinking is like, oh, mobile's less, right? You can't run ads on mobile. Nobody buys anything on mobile, all these kinds of things. Yelp, 40% of their search ads are now on mobile. Facebook makes 53% of their money on mobile, and Twitter makes 75%. So a way to summarize what I've been saying is mobile, 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 mobile. Right? And I think that's really exciting because of that opportunity and these new audiences that we can reach and all the things that we can do for our businesses there. But in addition to that opportunity, I think there's another thing that's more of a challenge than an opportunity, which is the reason I walked through my career from the mid-90s up until now is because that's what I've been doing for the past 20-something years. Every single day, I fire up a laptop, I sit in front of the laptop, I use a keyboard, I plug into a power supply, and that's how I get my work done. And to sort of illustrate this, how many of you have been using a laptop or desktop for 5 years? Just put your hand up. Okay, how many of you have been using it for 10? Keep it up if you've been using it for 10. Okay, 15? 20? Okay, you're all really old. That's the first thing we just learned. But the second thing is, it's really ingrained in our heads. Right? The idea of what a computer is, if you use the same sort of piece of hardware and software for 20 years to do everything you do in the digital world, that is what a computer is, right? It's so stuck in the back of our minds that it's very hard to shake. And I think there's a real big impact that comes from the fact that most of us started in this environment with personal computers, and we continue to this day to use these kinds of devices. Even if you're designing mobile apps and mobile software, you're probably using a PC to do it. Right? You're spending multiple hours on these kinds of devices that look like that. And in reality, this goes even further back. And I sort of touched on 20 years, but if you really want to trace the growth of PCs, so let's go further back than 1995 all the way to 1984. Anybody know what happened back in 1984? Other than that scary thing with the cameras? Right? Orwellian, what was it? The IBM PC came out, that's a good one. But whatever you consider to be the sort of pinnacle of consumer computers, right, whether it's the Mac or whether it's something else, these things came out back in the 80s. And in the 80s, they had a keyboard and a mouse, not the TRS-80, it had a tape recorder, what have you. But so since the mid-80s up until 2014, there's been mice and cursor in our lives. And we have used interfaces and created interfaces for those input types, for those kinds of devices. The whole paradigm of a window and icons, menus, pointers, right? This whole WIMP model is all created to be used with these kinds of devices. And what's what we sit on every single day and everything we do all day, which is usually answering emails, trying to get Outlook to work, or whatever it is you do in your lives. It's all by like clicking on these little icons and little pointers and moving them, right? How much time do you spend like resizing little windows all the time? My desktop has looked like this for 20-something years, and it continues to look like this for 20-something years. And when you really pull back and look at a lot of the design decisions for the graphical user interface, many of them stem from needing to support these kinds of inputs. And Jason Grigsby, for those of you that caught his talk, talked about like all the varying forms of input we're dealing with today. But input and output has a huge impact on the kind of design we make. And it's been with us for a long time. So to put this in perspective and kind of outline what's been happening, if we trace back to 1984, that's 30 years of personal computer use. If I be very generous and I say the modern mobile era, the smartphone and tablet era, started in 2007, which is when the iPhone was first announced. If I be really generous, that gives us about 6 years worth of learning. It didn't really get going until a couple of years after that, right? It was sort of like this new thing that nobody really did anything with. So generously, we've had 6 years to figure this out, whereas we've had 30 years ongoing of the other stuff. And so that creates an interesting situation in two ways. One, it means we actually have a bunch of stuff to learn about mobile. There's all these new things we have to figure out that, frankly, we just haven't had that much time to figure out. But perhaps more importantly, and I think more challengingly, which isn't a real word, but now it is, but I think the bigger challenge is how do we actually unlearn all this stuff that we have? The stuff that's ingrained in the back of our heads from day-to-day personal computer use. And to illustrate this lots to learn, lots to unlearn thing, let me show you an e-commerce experience. Right, so many of you probably spend time here, probably too much time here, if you're like me, right? Because they make it so easy to buy, you're just buying anything. But this is very much an interface created for the conventions of mice, keyboards, you know, large sort of screens, if you will, search, URL bars, all managed by typing, links managed by clicking with a precise little cursor, big layout taking advantage of the screen, everything sort of designed within that structure. Now, when Amazon takes this interface that they created long before there were modern mobile devices, and they port it over to, let's say, a native iPhone application, you can see it's 90% the same thing, right? With search results, they got a little less stuff in them, which frankly, you know, there's probably a most important set of information that they could apply everywhere, but since they got more room, they're like, why not throw it in, right? And then they use some native OS controls to allow you to refine and navigate around here. But for the most part, this is taking what we've been doing for those 29 years and porting it over to a smaller screen, if you will. Let me contrast that with another thing that Amazon does. Now, there's a lot of debate about, you know, should companies have multiple native applications and mobile, you know, should we have three apps or one app, and should we have category apps? Amazon has a really interesting approach, at least looking at it from an outsider's perspective, because they'll release a couple native applications here and there, and if those things turn out to be interesting, they fold it back into their main app, and it becomes a feature of the main Amazon native application. And so this is one of those applications that started life as its own thing, and as of about a month ago, has actually gotten folded into the core Amazon experience. And it's called Flow, and the way it actually works, the best way I can describe it is a magic shopping wand for the world. So what you do is you just take your phone and you point it at things. So it's like, oh, is that a book? Oh, I know that book. Hey, you want to buy that book? Look at, oh, is that a barcode? Huh, what that is that? Oh, it's another book. Hey, how about buying that? Oh, what is this? Oh, a CD? You want to listen to it? You want to buy it? Huh, huh. Ooh, a barcode, what is this? Oh, that's like a disc. You can look at this video. I don't even know what it is. Buy it. Let me just show that again. Magic shopping wand for the world. In real time, it's identifying the things that it's seeing in the camera viewport and giving you one-click access to purchase it. So I'm on my back porch grilling because it's California and we can do that. I run out of the seasoning. Still have the grill tongs in my hand. I pull out my phone from my pocket. I point it at that seasoning. It comes up with one click. I push buy. I put it in my pocket. It shows up the next day at my house. Right? How different is that experience from this? A little bit different? A lot of bit different? And I'm not suggesting we're all going to go run around shopping by pointing our phones at things, right? But what I am saying is if all we're doing is relying on everything we've learned about interface design and interaction conventions and visual design from those 29 years of PCs, moving to this kind of interface is a really big leap, right? You got to let a lot of stuff go to get to this point. You got to actually learn a few new things as well. So with that example, right, this is what I want to spend the bulk of my time talking about. So illustrating some of these examples of where we've got lots of things to learn, but also really highlight many places where there's things that we need to unlearn and kind of let go of, if you will. And as I'll probably say one too many times, this is the harder side of this slide. Right? Picking up a new skill here and there, you may be grudgingly doing that. Giving up on stuff that's worked for you for 30 years, that is a lot harder to do. So what are one of the things that's actually worked for us? Well, we've been really spoiled because we've gotten bigger and bigger screens over the years. Right? We've gotten these huge things, and people will debate over what the right screen size is for a PC, but it is way bigger than what you get on a mobile device. Right? Going from 1024 by 768 to 320 by 480, you're losing 80% of your screen space. And a lot of mobile design challenges, a lot of this unlearning, I think, happens when you don't go in this direction. That is, you don't start from this big screen experience and move it over to mobile. Because when you do, and you can see this in a lot of designs, especially on the web, right? Somebody will take their desktop site, they're like, okay, you know, we squeezed it into a single column. Mobile website. Right? I love the responsive design methodology for adapting to lots of different devices, but many responsive sites you look at are like, you know how we're going to solve mobile? One big long list. Great. And you may say, well, what's wrong with that, Luke? Well, let's take a look at one of the premier examples of responsive web design, the Boston Globe. And the folks that worked on this, super bright, and at the time they were really pioneering and doing sort of new things. So I don't fault them for the way this thing runs today, but let's look at this page for a second. So when I hit this page, it looks like there's a game going on and Obama is mad about something. That's like it. That's all I get. And then I scroll. And I scroll. And it turns out, oh, what was that? There's like some opinion. Oh, they have sports things here too. What? Metro? Nation in the world? Who knew politics was here? Business, hey. Going. I remove the ad. Going. Still going. They managed to fit it all in. Good. This is my friend Eric Runyon. He is holding a printout of the University of Notre Dame website. If they did nothing to optimize it for mobile. They actually do a bunch of interesting server-side things to adapt it. But if they took their homepage, this is just their homepage, and they put it on a mobile web experience, this is how long the thing would run. Let me actually put some numbers behind it. So if you take that web page and you make it 320 pixels wide, it is 26,115 pixels tall. It is 26,000 pixels tall. Let's just hammer home that point for a second. A 27-inch monitor with very high resolution only has 1,400 pixels in height. This is 26,000 pixels tall. Right? Does anybody see a problem with this? And again, it stems from like where we start, where we begin. We have this notion of what our website is. And when it comes to mobile, we're like, how do we fit it on mobile? And these are the kind of end results you get. And you may look at this and say, like, but Luke, you know, people will scroll. Yeah, people will scroll. I'm not saying scrolling is bad. There's always this fear of scrolling. Has anybody ever lived in fear of the scroll? There's this evil lord called the Fold who sort of reigns over the scroll, right? He's a tyrant. Because if you are in with the Fold, good things happen to you. If you're not aligned with the Fold, bad things happen for you. So 80% of people will engage above the Fold, but only 20% of people will engage below the Fold. There's all these kinds of stats, right, about the Fold. It's always this conception that scrolling is a bad thing. People won't scroll. Right? Everything should be within one click away. Remember that stuff too? That's also a good one. People won't scroll. Everything should be one click away. And other awesome heuristics you can use to design your website. Turns out this is actually not so true. So let me pose a question to you guys. This is a landing page for a service, right? So this is the control where they had a really simple call to action up above the screen. And above was the challenger that they ran a series of A-B tests around. Now, the challenger was actually 20 times as long as the control. 20 times as long. Which of these landing pages do you think converted better? The control or the challenger? Who says control? Okay, two people. Everybody else is getting the loadedness. Who says the challenger? Turns out the challenger actually had a 30% increase in conversion over the control. And there was a really interesting insight from this study that I'm going to call out here because I think it's worth mentioning. The problem isn't, is it visible above the fold? The problem, is it visible when you're ready to do it? Right? It's not like put a giant button on the page so people click on it when they have no idea what it is. It's have the right action available when they finally become convinced to act or when there is an opportunity for them to act. And I think this is a lesson we can take forward to smaller screens as well, right? This idea of having just-in-time actions that allow people to do things when it's appropriate. So scrolling's not bad. Josh Porter actually says this kind of nicely. Scrolling's a continuation, and an example that highlights it, right? You're like, am I interested in this? Let me read a little more. Oh, okay. Whereas a click is a decision. So people understand this context. If they sort of know the modality they're in, they will continue to scroll, and it's not an issue. Long pages and these sorts of things become an issue if you don't understand the context. So when you just take a web page and you fold it into one big scrolling list, there's this flat hierarchy, right? Everything's sort of equal. You got no idea what's down here. With that landing page, you sort of know there's more information about the product there. And the other thing that happens in mobile is if you're trying to take a large web page and load it onto a small device that people use on networks anywhere and everywhere, it's going to be painfully slow in most cases, right? It's going to incur a heavy download. Now, the University of Notre Dame guys do some really interesting things with server-side optimization and front-end optimization to not incur a heavy download for their big pages. But generally, taking this huge desktop thing and pushing it down to mobile is probably not the best idea. And I'm going to jump back to an earlier slide that I showed for half a second just to sort of paint this in context, because this is something I personally struggle with all the time, because I come from this PC era, right? And I look at this chart in my sleep, and I say to myself, am I doing bad to these guys by trying to make sure I support these guys and just thinking too much about that experience? Are my priorities inverted because I, in my head, have this understanding of what web pages, websites, and what software has been over the past 30 years. It's an interesting question. I encourage you to think about it a bit. So there's this flat hierarchy. There's this what's down here. There's this heavy download. And to illustrate this with the University of Notre Dame, right, if you sort of scroll this page, here's some university news things. Here's some magazine stuff. Down here's about info. Over here they have communities, academics, right? Who knows where all that is and what's coming? So in order to get around this issue, right, this everything's down here, you don't know what's here, there's been some interesting developments in mobile design to kind of address this. And one of the cool ones that I've seen people use and has gotten more and more popular is this idea of an off-canvas navigation. So rather than fitting everything into a single column, what you actually do is say, hey, maybe we can use some stuff off the screen for our content. Right? Instead of pushing everything off, let's make things accessible, but kind of bring them in where appropriate. You could see this in action on Google. Right? So you see those three little lines up there. And if you tap those three little lines, what it'll do is slide over this off-canvas menu, offering you more options. And then if you hit it again, it'll close up, and you're back to the page you're at. So you don't have to do this big scrolling thing. It's taking advantage of off-screen elements. And this is a pretty popular pattern. You can see it over here on ESPN. You hit the three little lines, and here it is over on Facebook. The icon itself has taken on a really interesting name called the hamburger icon. Maybe because it sort of looks like a hamburger. Some people call this the hamburger. When you actually dig into it, the hamburger icon doesn't like to be called the hamburger icon. He has his own Twitter account, and he likes to go by Mr. Liney. He doesn't want to be associated with fast food because he actually reveres himself, right? As he points out in his Twitter bio, I consider myself the most easily recognized icon on the web. And he's a little hoity-toity about it, as you can tell. And he'll tweet things like, yo, check me out on iTunes. Here I am. So the hamburger icon, or Mr. Liney, as he likes to be called, has become a pretty popular pattern. And I highlighted it over here on Facebook because I believe a lot of people saw it on Facebook and said, aha, Facebook is doing this. Right? Facebook uses the hamburger icon. Cool. Everybody gets it now. Have you ever heard this line? Facebook has trained 1 billion people on how to use that. Has anybody ever said that to you in a meeting? Right? Facebook has trained 1 billion people on how to use Mr. Liney. And so, as a result of this, you have many, 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 many implementations of this quote-unquote pattern. And I say quote-unquote pattern because I don't think it's a pattern just because people start doing it. A pattern is something that is repeatable in a specific context, and you understand the why you'd use it and how you'd implement it. Right? This is just copying. You're like, oh, yeah, you know how to do that. Right? And as I said before, you know, what are the rationales behind this? People say things like, oh, everybody's using it now, so people get it. Facebook trained 1 billion people on how to use this. And let's look at the Facebook trained 1 billion people on how to use this thing. I've worked with many corporations over the years, and there's always this outside perspective. They know what they're doing. They're clearly testing everything. Right? And then you go behind, you're like, oh, my God, that's why you decided to do that? Seriously? Right? And here's the story with the hamburger icon on Facebook. As of recently, they actually replaced this icon in their native iOS application, and they're doing this in other native apps as well, with this UI down here that uses the tab bar, a native iOS application control. And the reason why they actually made this change is they finally put an A/B testing system into their app. Before, they had been trying to shove all this JavaScript and HTML, CSS5 into a native controller. They had like 2-star ratings. The performance was terrible. And frankly, like testing the menu icon wasn't exactly a top priority. As soon as they fixed all that up and they put in a rigorous testing environment, they really quickly realized that thing performs really badly. So in their testing, they found engagement, satisfaction, revenue, speed, even perceived speed improves when they go away from that hamburger icon down to a visible set of icons. And you know, when there's lots to learn, it's comfortable to go look for easy answers, right? This is new stuff. So we're always grabbing at things that we think are solutions to our problems. And I think that's challenging because we run to a point where we're doing things but we don't really know why. And we make decisions based on, okay, Facebook's doing it. Turned out Facebook actually didn't know it was bad until they tested it and then they realized it wasn't good. And so I've brought some of these things up and I've had the pleasure of hearing from other people about their experiences with this interface, testing this interface. So Joe Leach, who's a user experience director over at CX Partners, sent me this info. He said, you know, we tested this hamburger icon with 15 people. 3 people got it, but they thought it was an Apple thing. Danny, who's a lead technical architect at AT&T, showed 9 out of 10 people had no idea what it was. So when people actually went in there and started testing this pattern, they found that there was actually some problems with it. And, you know, as we started talking about this, more and more people began to chime in with their experiences actually trying it out. I didn't realize it before my research, but people still don't know what it means. We had to start labeling it. People under 35 seemed to know it a little bit. Most people didn't get it, what have you. Right? And I don't mean to rag on this specific implementation here, but the meta point is it's that understanding of why and how things actually work that matters. Right? That's the learning piece. When I say lots to learn, I don't mean lots to copy. I mean lots to actually learn. So now we've seen the Facebook thing. We've heard sort of anecdotal usability studies. James Foster picked up on this stuff, and he decided to run a bunch of A-B tests. And he made those A-B tests public. And I'll share these with you because some interesting things come up from this. So in his first A-B test, he ran about 20,000 unique visitors through a comparison. And what he did is he took the hamburger icon, he put the word menu underneath it, and then he took the hamburger icon and he put a kind of button shape around it, if you will. Something that looks a little bit like an affordance. Bless you. And what he found was when they added the little word menu, the amount of engagement actually went up. Right? That little bit of clarity on what this thing was allowed a good number of people to actually start interacting with it more. But perhaps more surprising, or for those of us who like affordances, less surprising, is making it look like a darn button actually had an even bigger impact. Right? I'm sorry, iOS 7. We could talk about that later, but this little addition of an affordance of making it look button-like actually helped a lot. And then he ran another test. So he ran another test. He did it for about 5 days. He had 50,000 unique users, and they were in the 25 to 34-year-old demographic. And this time he tried a few more things. He took the winner of the last contest, hamburger with a patty around it, the word menu with an icon next to it, and just the word menu. Compared against the control, which is the hamburger up top, the word menu performed quite well. The inclusion of the icon actually made things worse. Right? It turns out that just the word menu is actually enough to say menu. You don't actually have to put a cryptic icon next to it. Go figure. But even more perhaps surprising was that this did so much worse. And what's missing? The affordance. It doesn't look like something that's tappable. And, you know, again, Android and iOS guidelines in the OS, those interface guidelines that they have are about a holistic experience across the whole OS. They don't necessarily take into account the specific context under which you're trying to design. So treating them as law sometimes is dangerous. Because if you've got an important primary call to action and you just make it text up in the header like this, chances are you may actually be doing yourself a disservice. And I think it's also telling that if you look at some of the point releases in iOS, they now have quote-unquote accessibility options to bring the buttons back. It's a feature called button shapes. So if this wasn't enough, James did one more final test, 50,000 mobile visitors, right, to really nail home the statistical significance thing. And he took the winner of the first test against the winner of the second test, and this time he had 240,000 unique mobile visitors. The last one was 50,000. So it's close to 250,000 people hitting this, right, to again get a decent amount of statistical significance. And the word menu was selected 20% more than the icon. Now, what does this tell us? It tells us two things, right? Affordances still matter. Making things look actionable is still important. It also tells us that words are going to be clearer than icons, no matter how ubiquitous or self-important those icons feel they are. But the third thing it tells us is, like, that stuff's kind of a duh. Right? You don't need all this A-B testing to figure it out. You know how you can know? You can go to a website like Time Inc., which has replaced their navigation with this menu, and you can see what they're doing here. Hey, nobody can tell that's an icon for menu. Let's add the word menu. Okay. Hey, nobody's clicking on this. Let's do a call out. Okay. Hey, this is the navigation. Okay? Okay. Right? You can sort of hear the conversations. Oh, we buried the sections behind this icon. Oh, crap, nobody's going to the sections. Our page views are going down. We need them going to the sections. All right, let's add the word. Oh, they're still not going there. Let's do a call out. You know, at that point, I don't need A-B testing to tell you there's an issue here. You can see it in your interface. Right? So while the data can help us make these decisions, I think when we find ourselves doing contortions, that's another sign that maybe what we're doing is not the right thing. And, you know, the other piece to this is it's actually okay if you put things behind a cryptic icon that you don't care if people find it, right? You may say, oh, you know what? Yeah, people can't recognize it that much. That's okay. That's only for situations where they get really desperate to find the things they want. Fine. That's totally valid, right? If you've got like 50,000 pages and you want to sort of hide 30,000 of them, sure, throw them behind an icon. You're good. But if it's stuff you actually care about, like these favorite sections, which I'm assuming Time cares about. No, I didn't work on this project. I assume they care about it. Otherwise, they wouldn't call it out like this, right? If they care about it, then maybe you don't want to put it there. And let me illustrate this another way. So I have a startup that I run right now, and we have this mobile application. And inside the mobile application, early on, we had this segmented control. And what this segmented control allowed you to do is really quickly see these little polls and questions from people that you were following. You could see the most popular ones, or you could sort of browse more of them. And so we had really clearly up front this controller allowing you to switch between these views. And when we went and did a redesign for iOS 7, we actually moved this to this toggle menu pattern, where up at the top, there's a menu control that brings down a menu and then closes it back up. So you can tap that menu, it comes down, and then you can bring it back up, and you're back on the page that you were at. And we did a decent amount of stuff to try and make this look like an affordance, right? So it sort of looks like a menu button, right? The arrow down, this curved little button thing. Well, you know, we weren't being totally irrational by moving to this. And, you know, what sort of prompted us to go in this direction is we started to see lots of other apps doing this, lots of other applications using this toggle menu pattern. So here's Vine, which is a popular video sharing service. You can see they have this home icon thing where if you toggle it, the menu comes down and you can interact with it, decide where to go. This is Kickstarter, and you know, I also have a little bit of a 3D bevel to that menu. So again, you can bring that down, navigate around, close it up, and make your way through it. Now, being a somewhat prudent startup, we tend to measure the things that we do. And one of the things that we care about a lot is how much activity each of these questions is getting. So if people will post a question and they get replies, then they're more likely to post another one. And the more replies they get, the better they feel about themselves, right? So we care about that metric. We track that metric. And with our segmented control, we were having a decent amount of votes per question, right? Somebody put something up, they'd get a good amount of feedback, and they'd interact with it. Then we launched this toggle menu. Anybody care or guess what happened? Oh, man. Just fell off a freaking cliff. Right? And it's the same thing that happened with the hamburger icon. We hid these things. We put them behind a tap. We put them behind a control. Even our best efforts to make it look kind of like a control didn't count enough. So if it's important, it should be visible. And needless to say, we quickly did a redesign where we brought those things back. And me as a designer, I sort of cringe at these. It's like, oh, they're kind of ugly up there. And I wish it was cleaner and just simpler and just had one link, right? That was one of the things that prompted us to do the last thing. We're like, look at how pleasing it is. It is just one thing. But it turns out that was actually a bad thing. And so the segmented control is back. And again, the only reason these things are front and center for us is because that's a really important thing for us, right? Maybe for Time it's really important to get people to sections. Maybe it's not. If not, fine. And you may say, okay, well, now I'm in a really big bind. Because Luke, you're telling me if something's important, I have to put it on the screen, but my screen is tiny. What do? Right? The screen is small. Like, if it's important, it has to be on the screen. I'm screwed. Well, I think this is actually an amazing forcing function. I love this constraint. Because you basically have to figure out, okay, what's important? What content, what actions are actually important? Because if they're important, we got to put them on the screen. We don't have a lot of room. We have to fit them. We have to have hard conversations about what's really important. It's great. And if there's, you know, secondary stuff that's not as important, maybe it's like complementary content or some secondary actions or whatever, bless you. Great. We can put that behind a toggle menu or put that behind a hamburger menu or an off-canvas menu or whatever. Right? But the biggest kind of pain I have here with the hamburger menu is not the fact that people don't get the icon or they don't make it look like a button. Those are things that are all addressable. You can manage that. My biggest issue with the hamburger icon and the hamburger menu is the way people understand it is like, oh, I have 5,000 levels of navigation on my website. How do I put it on mobile? Oh, behind hamburger. Good, done. Right? It becomes this crutch. You don't make this hard decision. You don't have to rethink what you've been doing for the past 29 years, you just find a place to put your menu and it's behind this little icon. That's the more troubling thing to me, right? It's not a crutch to automatically transfer this giant thing and prevent you from having to do the hard work of what matters. For the record, what we currently do across our multi-device design for the same application is we have a control for menu. We use a text label. We try to make it real high contrast so it seems button-like. We even throw in a little icon there to support it. So that's accessible. But then we also take these contextual actions, these important actions based on where you are, and we expose them. And we don't try to expose every action everywhere. What we do is say, okay, based on where you're at and what you're doing, these are the most important things, and so we're going to put those front and center and make them visible due to smaller screens. And that's a great forcing function for all kinds of screens. Right, as I was saying before. So, hopefully that little fast food interval illustrates what I've been trying to get to. If they're like, we got some things to learn, right? But we've also got a lot of things to unlearn. Your best course of action is probably not fitting your existing desktop website navigation onto mobile. And when I say learn, I don't mean, you know, see what Facebook's doing and just do that. I mean, like, actually learn from it, right? Test it out. Try it. If you can't test it, try it. Get information from other people that can. And learn what's behind this motivation. Because that's where you actually get to making good design decisions. So let's look at another example of this. And this was really, you know, I find when people work on websites and software, there's really two things that bugger them the most. One is navigation, right? Menus seems to always come up over and over again. And the other one is forms. Now, people basically spend all their time like figuring out navigation and figuring out forms, and that's the bulk of what they do. And so, looking at this exact same pattern, when you start from the big screen and you go down to mobile, but this time in input context, I think reveals similar things. So for a while, I've been kind of highlighting this pain point that I have personally because I fly. And when I fly, I try to get on the internet at airports, right? And I encounter services like Boingo that tell me, hey, you know, just set up your account, tell us about your firstborn child, submit all your information to us so you can pay us $7 to get online for an hour. You know, these guys have figured out that mobile is important, so they've taken that whole experience, and here's step one, two, and three of five of getting online at an airport. And just steps one, two, and three add up to 23 inputs. It takes them 23 different sets of inputs for me to pay them money to access the internet. And since I've been talking about this for a little while, there's a really kind marketing manager over at Boingo who every now and then sends me an update and says, hey, you know, we heard that this is not good. We've been trying to implement it. So he sent me this recent redesign that has 11 less input fields. Right? He was pretty excited about it. Notably, and I think he had good reason to actually be excited about it, because this redesign boosted conversion 34%. If you're the guy at the company that raises conversion 34% on your like primary funnel, right, they name a cake after you. And they serve it at the cafeteria on Thursdays, right? It's Bob's cake day. And he also liked to point out that this led to a 53% decrease in sign-up times, which is cool. And I say, you know, that's great, but I think actually you could do a lot better. Because I have a design for this that only uses 4 inputs, and that's counting the button. And it achieves the exact same thing, gets people online, gets you money. And this example of, let's say you are Boingo and you care about giving people access to the internet. Turns out maybe what they actually care about is like getting you tricked into a monthly payment plan, but whatever. Let's assume they're trying to do the right thing by the customer and not trick you into subscribing to a monthly plan you don't know about. Just, I don't know why I'd assume that, but I'll just assume that. Then this example of, okay, that flow matters to them. That flow is critical. This is an example of this process that Tim Cook actually does a really great job describing. Because he says the idea of being creative is really caring enough about something to find the simplest way of doing it. Right? If something's important to you, can you iterate and get down to the easiest way of making it happen, to sort of the bare essence? And I love this quote because to me this is what design's about. Right? With design, the way my design process works is I usually take a whole bunch of stuff and sort of barf it on the screen, and I spend the rest of my time trying to figure out what can I remove, how can I simplify, and get it down to what its bare essence is. Right? His association of this with creativity really resonates with me. And I love this idea that this is the process. You just kind of keep iterating on it until you find the simplest way of doing it. And to illustrate this, I want to show you guys a travel booking service. This is Hotel Tonight. And what Hotel Tonight does is it allows you to get a hotel tonight. Shocking, I know. But literally, you open up this mobile service, and up pops hotels near you that have availability and have good deals and have been vetted by this firm. Right? So they're only showing you good hotels at a good price near you. That's it. If you want to book one of these, all you have to do is tap on the one you're interested in. It'll show you some info about the hotel. You click book room. It tells you the total price. You click confirm booking. And then what you have to do is you actually have to trace their logo with your finger in order to complete the transaction. What? Why would they do that? It turns out babies were booking hotel rooms. They had a certain percent of returns because cats would get at an iPad and would actually book a hotel room. That's how easy they had made it. So they went through a couple iterations where they actually inserted this section where people had to like draw their initials, but that felt sort of too legal. And then they came up with this idea, oh, just trace our logo, which is kind of like a fun brand building thing, but it also verifies you're not a cat or infant. And I like this example because this is one of the few times I've ever heard the CEO of a big internet company, you know, Hotel Tonight's pretty large in the travel space, especially in mobile, say a form is a competitive advantage for them. He basically says, look, getting a hotel is 3 taps and then that swipe. It's like a 4-gesture interaction to book a hotel room. And we feel this is a competitive advantage for us. Now, how can a form design be a competitive advantage? What he continues to say is, here's Hotel Tonight, right? 4 taps, 1 swipe. It takes you about 8 seconds to book a hotel room. 8 seconds. And he says, look at what happens on our competitors. So here's Priceline. It also allows you to book hotels on mobile. 52 taps and 102 seconds. So notably a little bit more work. Hotels.com, 40 taps, 109 seconds. Also notably a little bit more work. And you may say, Luke, how is it possible that there's that much more tapping? Isn't this like a pretty standard flow, right? Book a hotel. How can they possibly make it that much more work? Well, let's look at hotels.com. Right? So out the gates, they've got like some deal. So I hit search, 1 tap, and I'm on the search screen. And it's done this nice job of pre-filling my location, San Jose. And it defaults to tonight, great. So it's sort of doing the Hotel Tonight thing. 1 night, 1 room, 1 adult, fine. That all seems great. Notice none of that stuff was visible in Hotel Tonight. Just take it for granted that that's what you're doing. And then you hit search again. I'm in San Jose, California. What do I do? So I take pause and I think, And I literally have to guess, right, which one of these is the correct answer. Because I am actually in both. Both could technically be correct, but so I pick one, and then I'm back on the search screen. Can you see how this could quickly add up to more than 4 taps? I haven't even seen any results yet. And I think this is an illustration of this bigger picture issue, right? Because when you look at Hotel Tonight and you compare it to hotels.com, I think it illustrates this challenge that it takes really big changes to go small. And what do I mean by that? Well, let's look at what else hotels.com has in their native app. They have a whole search feature. They have a search by star rating feature. They have a max price, min guest rating, series of filtering options. There was a whole team dedicated to managing that location database and providing QA on it. Right? They came up, oh, we have all these different locations. Look at how accurate it is. There's a whole team that's ingesting star rating feeds, checking them for spam and for quality, removing things that are good or are not bad, right? Normalizing the data, keeping that up and running. Search, there's probably a whole team of 30 engineers, half a designer, likely, and like 15 PMs, right? Or 50 PMs, to be more accurate. It's like 50 PMs, 10 engineers, and like a quarter of a designer working on that feature. And that's true for all these features. But this is what happens when you come from this established structure. To hotels.com, this is what a hotel booking experience is. Right? Of course it has search. It has to have search. Right? Of course it has to have star ratings. We've always had star ratings. And let's say you go in there like, no search, no star ratings, no min-max price. We're just going to show you 5 hotels near you, good price, good value. That's it. Every single one of these teams is going to be raising their hand and be like, you forgot about search team. Right? Hey, yo, ratings team. They're not wrong. Their understanding of the product is based on their part in it. If you want to go to hotels.com and say, hey, we're going to do mobile booking and, you know, search team, sit this one out, ratings team, thanks, guys, you're done, and like really cut off 75% of your existing product, guess how many meetings you're going to be in explaining it to those people? You're basically going to be creating PowerPoint for the rest of the year, and you're never going to ship anything. It's a big change. Another example over here on Yelp. So Yelp has actually been on mobile for many years. They had a WAP site early on. They had BlackBerry apps. They've been doing a lot of mobile stuff. It's this local ratings and reviews thing. And though they've been doing mobile for many years, they've had one consistent request all those years for mobile, which is, please let me write a review on my mobile phone. It's been such a consistent request that poor Eric, who runs products over there, has had to write a blog post. Why can't I write reviews on my mobile? Well, you know, imagine if reviews were done in SMS, it would be so bad. And he just goes on and on explaining how you can't do it. Personally, I would love it if you could leave little emoji poo reviews at restaurants. Because, like, seriously, you see 3 emoji poos, are you going to eat there? No. You're done, right? That would be an amazing rating system. Hotel Tonight, on the other hand, also enables people to do reviews, but they actually allow them to do it on mobile. In fact, they encourage it. The way you leave a review for a hotel stay at Hotel Tonight is they just give you this little blank card of photos, and you just take a picture of your room, take a picture of the lobby, take a picture of, you know, the bathroom, and that's it. You're done. They know you booked the hotel room because you did it through their app. They know you're in the hotel room because they have location detection, right? You have your phone with you. So it's like an authentic, genuine review of somebody who booked the hotel room is actually in it. And frankly, you know, what would you rather do when trying to decide whether or not to go to a hotel? Would you like to just flip through a bunch of pictures of people who actually stayed there, like this? Oh, okay, that looks good. Or do you want to read some, like, prose that was written by, you know, some episodic reviewer? 'Twas a foggy morn in Monterey when Ben and I decided to head out from our estate. Snuggles the puppy wasn't feeling quite well, so we were a little distraught when we headed into the automobile. Luckily, as we arrived, as the gallant entrance of the co- Shut up, is it good or not? But again, the Yelp review system was born of those 29 years of PCs. Why is a Yelp review a bunch of prose? Because it's a keyboard, right? It's comfortable to sit there and type on a big monitor and sort of interact like that. And on a big monitor, you can kind of read and take these things in. Those constraints and those opportunities don't exist in mobile. And 4 years after Yelp continuously got asked to add reviews, and 59% of their traffic is now on mobile, 40% of their ads are served on mobile, they finally released the feature that says you can now add a review. But of course, to ensure their high quality, we might remove any that are too short. Takes big changes to go small, right? What you understand about the value of your business and how it works, I think, is up for negotiation, if you will. That's the whole, yeah, we got some things to learn about how to optimize those forms for mobile and take an input. You know, that's an important part of it, but there's a whole lot more to unlearn. To go back to what I've been up to for the past X number of years, so I did a great run at eBay and at Yahoo, and then, you know, this plateau kind of happened. And coincidentally, it was around that time that I left Yahoo and ventured into the startup world. So around 2009, we started a company called BagCheck, sold it to Twitter back in 2011. But it was a very different world than working at the big organizations I had worked in before. And the real big reason why startups are so different than large companies is because when you are a startup, you have to learn everything. You have to learn everything. You don't know who your customers are. You don't know what product you're going to build. You don't know how it's going to work. You don't know what the interaction design is going to be. You don't even know what the back end is going to be. Literally, everything has to be learned. You're starting from scratch. You have to learn how to hire people. You have to learn how to pay them. You have to learn everything, right? Organizations, big organizations that have been around for a while, have probably learned too much and have a real hard time unlearning things. But when you're a startup, you have to learn everything. So when you're in a startup, arguably, the most important criteria in a startup is the ability to learn quickly. You have so much to learn that you need to figure out how to do it as fast and effectively as possible. So my time in startups really keyed me into, and I've been doing startups now since 2009, but it's really keyed me into this notion of how can we learn fast. And I think these are relevant points to what we're talking about right now because mobile has only been around for so long and because change is so rapid. And I think this is also why a lot of big organizations are so interested in startup culture. Right? Has anybody worked at a company that's like, we act like a startup? Right? We have startup culture. All of them are super fascinated with things like agile and lean UX and lean company and all these things because they want to infuse this ability to move more quickly. And I think that moving quickly doesn't matter unless you're learning, right? I can run really fast into a wall and I can just keep repeating that. It doesn't do me any good. And I can get faster and faster at hitting that wall. And arguably, it's going to be actually worse for me the faster I get, right? So it's not about moving fast. It's about learning fast. And the way I could sort of encapsulate this into a big picture thing, and then I'll show you guys some practical tips, and then I'll let you digest them. Big picture, this means put stuff out there. You can't learn unless you do something, right? Unless you release something, unless you try something, there's no opportunity for learning. So you got to get good at releasing things. When you release it, observe what's happening. This is going back to the hamburger icon and all the things I've been talking about. Like, actually see what people are doing and refine it. Chances are you released kind of quickly. You didn't really know everything. So if you just leave it there, you're not going to have that opportunity to iterate and learn. And the third one is just keep doing it. Right? Keep repeating it. One of the most challenging things I see inside of large companies that want to be startup-like is they release and walk away. Right, that release is done. On to the next release. Right? So it's got to be this loop, right? Put stuff out, iterate, observe it, repeat, and keep going. And what are some ways to do this? One of the things that we did over at BagCheck back in the day was we started with an API. And an API is something that allows us to be very presentation independent. So if we have to do like 3 native apps or a website or we have to put something on a watch, we have the core essence of the application available to all those different front ends. The other thing that starting with this API allows you to do is think in terms of what does it have in it and what do those things do? Right, sort of the structural layer. What are the core actions? What's the core content? And how are those things interrelated? That's a fundamental understanding of your service that will help you for every single UI you ever build. And the first UI we put on top of this API was actually a command line interface. There was no graphical user interface whatsoever. we literally spent 2 months or so just doing everything by command line. And this was a service for creating lists of things. So you could fire up the command line and say, hey, open this app. And it would tell you all the things that it can do. And then we would say, OK, show me a bag, which is what we call a list. Here's all the things that you can get out of a bag. And you'd say, OK, I want to add an item to this list. OK, what item do you want to add? I want to add some toast to it or whatever. Right, but like all the actions, all the attributes, all the objects were all clearly visible and in this resolution independent interface. And not only does that allow you to be very nimble on where you put that stuff, but I think it forces you to make these core decisions around the basics of things, which again lets you go faster. Then once we had this sort of core API layer, another thing that we did was we really tried to separate the front end from the back end. If anybody's ever gotten in a situation where there's this muddled code in the middle that like does some of your logic and some of your, it just turns into a big mess. But if you use something like Mustache, I think actually Brad Frost talked about Mustache when he talked about atomic design. What you can really do is just throw a couple variables in here, and this code, you can use it to render data on your local machine. Or me as a designer, I can just push this file up to the server, and then the server will fill in that exact same data. So I never step on the toes of my engineering counterparts, right? I push the file, they fill it, and it's just seamless. It works really, really well. Another thing that we did was we had this real-time observation system where at any point in time we could go see who was on our site, and we could see every single action that they're doing. So click, 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 clicked. A look, went off the site for a minute, oh, came back, click, 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 ran a search, that's the term he used. And you could just stare at this thing all the time, seeing everything people were doing in real time. The other very cool thing is you could click on any one of those links and go and see your service as that person. If you were logged in, it would look kind of like this to you. If you were logged in as that person, it would look like this to you. And you notice this garish admin background back there? Very, very quickly, I had to add this horrendous background layer because people got confused who they were in the application. Right, so we didn't want to go doing anything incorrect while we did that. But so there's something really powerful about at any point in time seeing what's happening on your service and being able to view your service as any user on your service. Right, it creates a huge amount of insights. And it allowed us to do this thing that I call preemptive customer service. So preemptive customer service means we're watching this admin system. We're like, oh, my, what's this guy doing? Oh, it looks like he's having an error. Oh, is that a bug? Oh, let's fix that real quick. And then email them or tweet them and say, hey, we saw you had a bug. Really sorry. We just fixed it. And sometimes I get this comment like, oh, that's sort of creepy. I've never had anybody reply and be like, you creep? Instead, everybody's like, oh, my God, you what? I had a bug. You fixed it before I could even tell you about it? That's amazing. Right? They love this experience. It shows you somebody cares. And I practice this to this day. Like, I will go and do things for people that they don't even know they need done. And again, to this day, I've never heard anybody say, you creep. Right? Instead, they're very, very, very grateful that somebody cares enough to actually fix things for them before they know they need fixing. So this idea of preemptive customer service is also a great way of learning fast. So it's not just being able to build quickly, which is what those logicless templates and APIs did, but it's also the opportunity to learn quickly, right? See in real time what people are doing, view your services as them, and then actually start to talk to them. Kicking off those conversations is a great thing. One of the mistakes I realized literally this morning that I made in our current startup was I made the contact us link way too small. And like sitting in the back during a talk, I was literally making a giant contact us label that I'm going to shove on every single page of the site because talking to people is that important for learning. So, given we've had this much time, right, hopefully this idea of getting better at learning is something that resonates. Again, I do feel like that's one of the things that's hopefully driving all this. We need startup DNA. We want to function like a startup in organizations. So to summarize all this stuff, and I think we'll have about 5 minutes for questions, which is great. This growth in mobile is a huge opportunity. Whether it's audience size, whether it's revenue, whether it's things like email or commerce, we've been hitting the mobile moment left and right. All right. So with that comes this great new series of audiences that we can now reach with our services, with our applications, with our products, what have you. With that, though, comes some challenges, right? It's not just figuring out all this new stuff. It's actually figuring out what do we let go of? How do we adapt? And as I've said before, these aren't small adjustments. Many a times, they're actually big changes that you need to push through an organization. I like to say, if people are like, okay, yeah, that sounds fine, then you're probably not going far enough. If your suggestions for mobile are making people uncomfortable, right, and they're feeling like, whoa, then maybe you're going the appropriate degree far enough. Again, consider the difference between Hotels.com and Hotel Tonight, right, or the way Hotel Tonight approaches reviews compared to Yelp. And then last but not least, this notion of releasing, refining, and repeating. Like, it doesn't seem to me in any way, shape, or form that the rate of change is going to slow down. Right? If you think, like, innovation and the rate at which new devices, new services, and all this stuff is all of a sudden just going to, like, lull out, I hate to break it to you, but it's probably going to get even crazier. So this change is going to continue, and it's going to continue getting faster. And as a result, this idea of getting stuff out there, seeing what happens, and making that your mindset versus monolithic releases will really help you adapt to that world. So that's what I had to talk to you guys about. Thanks.
For more great UX resources, visit uie.com. That's uie.com. As always, thanks for listening.